Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're going to hear them. It's all good, man. There might be some stories floating around.
I love it. I actually like to make the claim that the town I'm from in the U.S. has got the highest characters per capita ratio in the U.S. It really is an odd little community that I'm from.
Where are you
from? I'm used to funny folks. From a little town on the west coast of Oregon, down southwest coastline, Oregon, abandoned. Sorry, of course in Oregon. So abandoned by the sea. It's sort of famous now for some golf courses. But I grew up on a cranberry farm there, and I don't know why, but there's all these like world travelers, you know, it had like a little tiny seaport where sailboats would come in. And so we got all these people that would like travel around the world, stop in abandoned, and then just decided to make it home. So like up the road from us, we had a guy making samurai swords, like one of only 10 like Japanese professional samurai swords makers. Wow. And then across the river from us was the people that started the Oregon Country Fair. You know, and you know, some other folks had traveled, sailed around the world a few times and then landed and abandoned. It just was a weird combination of loggers and cranberry.
I always growers and cranberries. That's funny.
Well, it's a very small part of the cranberry industry in that neck of the woods. But yeah, you guys make it over there. Pops will still give you a tour if you want to see it.
It's awesome.
He's 70, still running the farm.
So don't cranberries grow like floating in the water? Don't you have to like walk through the bog to pick them and all that stuff? How does that work out?
So yeah, the last part is right. You pick them that way. But no, they grow otherwise out of the water. So they figured that was the best way to harvest them because people's fingers were literally bleeding before. It was a very like rich man's crop before they realized, oh, there's little air pockets in these berries. I wonder if we can float them. And so they developed these specialty machines, flooded the fields and knocked the fruit off and they pop up to the surface. That you corral them on top of the water. It's way easier.
Now I got to tell you, I mean, while the cranberries are very interesting, I really do have some interest in learning more about the guy that's making the samurai swords out there. Okay. So, I mean, is he still in business? Because I mean, first thing I'm thinking Kill Bill. You know, not that I have any vendettas or anything that I need to go in and go through, but just saying it would be nice to meet a guy that makes samurai swords.
I don't know. So I knew his son, and I know he was tapped by Hollywood to make a bunch of swords, and the guy only produces like 10 swords a year, and he turned the contracts down because he's like a purist through and through, and he's just like, no, you guys want too many swords, I can't make them in that time frame. So that get out of awesome. Dodge. I don't care how much money you want to give me. Yeah. He's very much a hermit, lives back in the hills, but like lived in Japan and learned the craft for like a decade before coming back to Oregon.
There's a lot of that going on in the little nooks and crannies. I mean, I know everywhere, but like, especially along the coast over there on the West Coast, like the nooks and crannies off of the coast, outside of the cities, you have these guys who are kind of hermits that specialize in some really amazing crafts that, I mean, I've been up there a few times in Northern California, especially, and some of the things you run into. I was noticing you went to school in San Luis Obispo. One of the things that I ran into that I had no idea that I even liked, there was a place downtown. It's called Splash Cafe. You ever been there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you ever have their clam chowder by any chance in the bread bowl?
Of course, man. That's legendary.
Oh my God. I'm going to tell you guys right now, if you're ever in San Luis Obispo, you have to go to Splash. I don't even like clam chowder. I hate clam chowder for the most part. And somebody's like, you got to try the clam chowder. I went there and I was like, this is some of the best food I've ever had.
Yeah. Slow is a really special spot. I don't know if it still is, but at least when I was going to college, I mean, I stuck around for a couple extra years just running a deli because I just love the area so much before I kicked off into the solar industry. But it won for several years, like happiest place in the U.S. to live, and fully understand why. I mean, the amount of sun that they get is unbelievable, and it's just nice combination of like the amenities in a small town or small city, I guess, combined with a lot of outdoor activities. So yeah, nice combo. I miss the place. Still have, you know, best man for my wedding lives there. So I get an excuse every now and then to get back and spend some time on the Central Coast. But that, and then up into Big Sur, you know, I went to San Luis Obispo. I got a computer engineering degree, but I really went to learn how to surf, and that I did. The surfing addiction really took me to a lot of places, but very much up into the Big Sur area, and that is a mystical place. Still probably my favorite area in the U.S. To get to. If you guys ever have a chance to go check it out. It's wild. I think I had a buddy that was state parks and rec, something like that. Like was a ranger at one of the state parks. And, he hooked me into doing the John Muir, through trail 1 year. And so I did that with him, and along the trail, he told me about how he had an obsession with Big Sur too, and meet some of the colorful locals that live there. And he told me he hiked into this place. A buddy took him to, met the 70-year-old dude that had made a living trapping cougars that were obnoxious. Wow. And he had built this house out in the middle of nowhere that you had to helicopter supplies into. And he raised his whole family out in that sort of condition. And now he's still in his 70s and still being called up every now and then to go hunt down a bad cougar. I was like, holy shit, did that stuff still exist?
Wow. That is very cool.
That is awesome.
I'm a little jealous.
Actually, oh, me too. I want to go visit this guy. There's some like Indian cave that he had that only he knew, and my buddy Jeff got to go see. I was like, what? I thought the Wild West was gone. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is amazing.
A lot of guys still out there that enjoy a good hunt, especially the cougars. Cougar hunts are on right now. I actually had a buddy the other day post a giant, another recon guy, and he posted a giant cougar that he was holding up. You know, snow's everywhere. A lot easier to track him in the snow. And boy, you want to talk about this giant lion. Anybody, if you've never been around mountain lions, and you're going to the West Coast, please exercise caution, people. Like it's those things are not to be played with. Anybody who's like, oh yeah, you know, it's just a cat. Like, no, it's not. Like those things will straight up jump on your neck from out of the nowhere, and you're done. Those are big kitties.
They are. Yeah. I actually think having lived in Europe, you know, the terms old world and new world still apply to me. And I do think that that fundamentally shapes the populace different when you still have predators in your midst. Oh, yeah. It makes a different type of person. And, you know, the European Union has been, or, you know, the European continent, I guess I should say, has been thoroughly domesticated at this point. It's hard to find anything dangerous over there.
Minus the central bank.
The most dangerous thing on the planet.
That's right. Should we kick it?
Let's roll.
Let's roll. Welcome to Bitcoin Veterans, everybody. I'm Shane Hazel. I have with me tonight Gabe Lord, Alex Stanzik, Jordan and Mike are off tonight. I don't know what they're doing, but they're not here. We really appreciate everybody that is showing up. This is Bitcoin Veterans. We do this every Thursday night at 7 p.m. With dogs and babies and everything else in the background, because that's what life is. We do this because at one point in our lives, we signed up to give our life for a bigger cause, for a fellow man, out of love. I think there's a lot of guys out there that are looking for something, looking for passion, looking for mission. They are all about self-sovereignty, freedom, liberty. And we believe here in Bitcoin Veterans that Bitcoin is that sovereignty. It is that freedom. It is that liberty. It is the revolution that we're all looking for. Tonight, we are joined by Kent Halliburton. He is the CEO of Saz Mining. And I got to tell you, this guy's got a long list of accolades, but he's also sounds like a really down-to-earth guy. He's been around the world for, I don't know, quite a few years now. And we're just lucky to have him. Thanks for coming on, Kent.
Yeah, and I'll apologize in advance. Dogs are a thing in the Amazon. They are. It is impossible to get away from them. Actually, we're almost done constructing a house that specifically has a room that will help with that. But until then, it is what it is. Yeah. So
honestly, I was just kind of putting it out there to see if it was yours or mine. Because as soon as she put it on mute, and I knew it wasn't mine, I was like, all right.
Not you. Victory for you. Yeah, I'm the bear's guy with the dog.
I can remember this one pod episode we were doing. We were all over at Shane's house, actually. And his dog, while we were in there, was in the studio with us. And that dude almost jumped out of the second story window during the middle of the pod. It was a trip.
He was chasing my AC-130 that was flying by, and he just like so yeah, you're in very good company here, Ken.
Good to know. Good to know. Yeah. So, CEO of SAS Mining, I got here by way of, I think, a lot of the same value set that you just talked about, Shane. So my first career was actually in rooftop solar, worked in that for about a decade, got a bit of burnout, and also just always had a dream of traveling and seeing the world. So in 2014, I chucked on a backpack and took off, do some adventures, traveled South America, Europe, a bit of the Middle East and Southeast Asia before I finally decided to plant roots. And along the way, I fell in love with both Bitcoin and a Portuguese woman. So circa 2016, I was planting roots in Portugal, you know, marriage, family, house, the whole bit, trying to hang out an entrepreneurial shingle for myself. And with my energy background, after a couple failed entrepreneurial pursuits and reading Jeff Booth's The Price of Tomorrow, I was like, well, duh, the cost curves of solar are going to be such that there's going to be an explosion with solar and mining. So why not go get ahead of that and go get myself involved with mining? So I met the founder of SAS Mining at that point, Will, through a mutual acquaintance, and helped him kick this business off in 2021, what we turned it into, raise some capital, and we've built a platform basically to make mining accessible to the masses, and doing it with all hydropower, so it's carbon free, but really came up with an interface that makes it intuitive in the same way like Uber made the rideshare experience intuitive. And we think by doing so, we can give a run at the exchanges for the acquisition strategy of choice for folks, because, you know, Satoshi designed this to be mined, not to be purchased at the exchange, and we still think that's the best way to do it.
Right on. Can yes. you are you able to disclose like where you guys operate out of, where your locations are, and how do you go about? I've had a lot of discussions with different mining company people over the last couple of years, and I'm not an expert in this, but what I've learned is that the cost of power is like a really big deal for you guys. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like if you're able to say where you're set up, and then also how you guys handle and determine how you're going to use power, where you get it from, and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. So it's very much still Wild West how you go about acquiring your power. And I think being an adventurous soul, that kind of appeals to me. I don't mind that. But the cost of power is your biggest input as a miner, right? So having a low cost of power gives you an edge when competing on the network for block rewards. And so we really focused on that. I have no problem telling you where we are. We're in Wisconsin and Paraguay. So our first facility we launched, you know, first half of last year and got that filled. And then second facility, we launched the second half of the year in Paraguay, and definitely posed some hard learning lessons dealing with customs and logistics and, you know, a new location. But I do live here in Peru. I've lived outside of the US for about a decade now and have learned a lot about how Latin America works. And so I felt confident leaning into that. But there's a lot of places around the world that have cheap power. And I think that is the first place. Like I've heard this metaphor that I think is a great visual if you can get it in your head. But if you imagine like electricity prices, like a topographical map, you know, it's all contoured, et cetera. And you think, okay, that topo map is made up where the mountain peaks are the highest electricity prices, and the valleys and the lakes are where it's the cheapest. Well, if you poured water over that topo map and see where that water settles out, that is where mining is going to exist first and foremost, because that's where the cheap power is. So it almost doesn't matter where on the globe you are. And I think that coming from the U.S., there's a lot of focus on like what's going on in the U.S., but the globe's a big place, man. It's way bigger once you start traveling around too and realize how big the damn thing is. But I just realized and said, okay, there's a lot of excess cheap hydropower, which is up and stable. Let's focus on that. It's clean, it's green, it's cheap, and it's what you need to mine profitably. It's that steady electricity. So yeah, that's why we chose Paraguay. And I can talk a bit about Paraguay because I think Paraguay is a specifically unique story if you guys are curious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Let's hear it. I'd love to hear about like the situation there. And
yeah,
are you guys using hydro in Paraguay?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can't not use hydro in Paraguay. That's the funny part. So the way the grid works, and so Paraguay is a landlocked country. It borders Argentina and Brazil and a couple other countries, but it's kind of this kidney bean shaped country inside of the coast on both sides. And on one of the borders with Brazil, there's a big river that Brazil and Paraguay decided in the 1970s to go in on and build a massive hydro dam. So it's a binational project, meaning they split the power that comes off of it, but it's a 14 gigawatt dam. And I'm telling you, like, it is the biggest infrastructure project I've ever seen. I went down there last July and checked it out. It's like 5 miles from one end of it to the other. I mean, it just blows your mind that man can even create something so big. So it's the second largest dam in the world behind Three Gorges. But by power density, it's actually got the title because of how much power it generates for per what is a cubic meter of water. So that's kind of a funny side note. But what happened is, Brazil's a big country. They could use 7 gigawatts of power, no problem. Paraguay couldn't. Small country, small economy. Well, the way they drafted the agreement, they have to sell the excess to Brazil, and they're basically doing that at cost or most of the time at a loss. And so it was just a net drag on their economy. Well, here come the Bitcoin miners. Great, you have all this hydroelectricity. We'll buy it off you. It's a win-win. It then becomes politically advantageous for the local political group there to say, hey, we're bringing jobs, we're bringing income in. That's going to equal votes. So there's just this natural incentive for miners to show up there. And in my opinion, I actually think it's very likely to become a Texas-like opportunity. I think there's some other places and pockets like that around the world, but in essence, they had, and I don't know how much has been gobbled up by miners at this point, but they had 4 to 5 gigawatts of excess hydro, in their country. And the beauty of this is that not only are we able to take a liability and turn it into an asset for their GDP, but we can also leave behind infrastructure that will be useful for growing a manufacturing base in the future.
That's incredible.
That is awesome.
When it comes to, you kind of mentioned politics very briefly there with, you know, the politicians and everything in this world has gotten very political. How do you see, you know, Bitcoin mining around the world, you know, right now in terms of, you know, is this something you see a lot of countries fighting, or do you see a lot of adoption? Is it, you know, really a mixed bag with a lot of nuance in it?
I think a lot of nuance, mixed bag, because there are some serious trade-offs. I mean, one of the major trade-offs that you've got leaving the U.S. is the rule of law. Like, for all else aside, the rule of law is quite strong in the U.S. for dealing with contracts, right? And who you know becomes a much bigger priority when you're outside the U.S. And finding the right relationships. So the way I see it is actually quite similar to the thesis I read from a lot of the early Bitcoiners in the early 2015, 2016 timeframe when I was first rocking it, which is, you know, the incumbent power structure resides with the U.S. money printer. And so there is an incentive to resist this disruptive competitive force. However that plays out, there's just that inherent incentive. And so if you're one of the smaller players off the geopolitical map, and you've got a bunch of extra electricity, it makes a lot of sense to just embrace it. And I think that's why we're seeing what we're seeing with the likes of Paraguay, El Salvador, Ethiopia now. You know, I think that it's an odd combination of factors, but, you know, the countries that look least likely to grab it are actually the ones that are most entrenched in the incumbent system.
Yeah, I mean, not just incentivized to embrace it, but why wouldn't you? You're sitting there with 4 to 5 gigawatts of excess power, and you have the ability to basically create your own money printer as a country, essentially. I mean, it's not going to be your money necessarily right off the get-go, depending upon your agreements. But, I mean, you have these superpowers like the United States with a money printer, and you have nothing to compete with that. But now you do. In a way, that's very interesting.
Well, to your point, like, we heard a lot of stories of politicians with containers of mining rigs mining their own Bitcoin because the local or the utility, the primary utility, Andy, is a state-run utility, right? So it's just like, okay, you guys clearly see the value of mining.
We have all of this power. Let's put it to use. That's funny. Something you said a little while ago about having interesting encounters with customs and whatnot. I sense there's some kind of a story there. Did something interesting happen with customs and importing mining rigs or something like that?
So everybody that does business in Paraguay comes to the realization that Paraguay's customs are truly unique. And what I mean by that is there's literally a song and dance that happens at the border every time you clear your mining rigs, and you can't really know what the outcome of that song and dance is going to be until it occurs. And it's funny because people have had, like, I work with other folks and say, oh, you know, I've imported from China into this country, that country, I understand, you know, I'll slap this invoice on this pallet of mining rigs and they'll accept it and charge the customs accordingly and off we go. But no, these guys, and the reason why is because it's actually a large part of their revenue. These guys will actually go to the websites of the companies and see, okay, what's the manufacturer say the price is? Okay, that's what we're charging it based on. And by the way, we're going to charge you the highest because you gave us the wrong number to begin with. And if you don't, within 5 days, we're going to impound it, charge storage fees and penalties on top of it. So you better get this right to begin with.
Wow. So, I mean, even if you're showing invoices for what you actually paid for the rigs, they don't really care about that. They just want the maximum fees they can get, right?
Yeah, so what I've learned is there's a specific reason for this. So they don't charge sales tax to consumers, and they have along the borders, like all these big shopping centers. So people come from Brazil or Argentina into like Ciudad del Este, which is the major city on the east, and they'll come in and shop and buy all these goods and services. So how they get around not having sales taxes, high customs fees for everything that comes across the border.
Got you. Fascinating. All right. Well, I know that Gabe was part of what got you talking to us for Bitcoin Veterans. I mean, as you mentioned before, I've spoken to you before, but Gabe's running this thing called Operation Bitcoin, where I'm not going to explain it all. I'll let you do that, Gabe. But it's a really cool thing that Gabe's doing for veterans, and I think it's one. I find it's a thing that people are probably most interested in, even though we have this huge array of things that we're doing with Bitcoin veterans. The thing that everybody raves about is Operation Bitcoin for the most part. So talk about that. What is Operation Bitcoin? Why what does that all have to do with what you're doing? And how is SaaS mining and Kent of interest for this?
Sure. Awesome. Thanks, Alex. So Operation Bitcoin started out as an educational initiative. We're a nonprofit that provides Bitcoin education to military veterans using the Mi Premier Bitcoin curriculum. We're powered by them. We are a light node with Mi Premier Bitcoin. And so that's really the core of our focus. And also, we have moved into the area of connecting military veterans once they go through the program with employment opportunities within the Bitcoin space. And we're finding that there's a huge demand for that because we've discovered actually pretty quickly that there's an alignment of values between Bitcoiners and veterans, which of course is why we're all here right now. And so we've got a lot of veterans running around our country, about 16 and a half million of them, and about 200,000 more are leaving the military every year. And when they're leaving the military, they're looking for careers that align with their values. And so there's a total imperfect fit, which is why we're focusing on that. And I know that that you have there's one I know of one veteran in particular that you have hired over the past few months, and we're gonna protect his identity right now. Hopefully, maybe we'll see what happens. But I'm curious to I'm always curious to learn from organizations that do see the value of hiring veterans. I'm curious to learn from them what it is that they see. And so I'm hoping that you could explain to us a little bit. What is it that, you know, either you saw in this particular individual or that you see in veterans in general that that make them an attractive source of talent for you to bring into your organization and or, you know, that other employers could see within the Bitcoin space that they would want to recognize that value and bring them into their organizations?
Oh, you're on mute there, Kent.
Let's fix that first, eh? So I definitely have stumbled across the same thing that a lot of the same reason why people signed up to serve in the military the Venn diagram has a high level of overlap between that and like the values of the folks that show up with Bitcoin. And I do think that those values are tremendously important to be successful as our organization has grown. I've gotten to the point where if people are not passionate about Bitcoin, you know, and maybe I shouldn't say this is a trade secret. Like that's my first screener is if there just isn't the off the cuff, because value set of, hey, I'm a Bitcoiner through and through. I've just found that there's a completely different work ethic. And that comes down to the same overlap with the value set. But for us in hiring, this is the third team that I've built in my career. And the first two, I would say I did horribly at. I was sub 50% success rate on sticking to landing with my hiring. And so when Will and I decided to build this business model, this was October 2021, the first thing I did was say, okay, let me focus on hiring practices because I'm going to build a team. I can't afford to mess up 50% of the time here. And so the first thing that we decided on our value set, and one of those was meritocratic in how we hire and promote within our organization. So part of that was I found a personality assessment objective by a third party that I was able to lean into and really trust. And so that's one of the first screeners. Once I know that somebody's a potential fit, I see those skills that I put everybody through, and that gives me an objective way to know that I'm talking to an A player that I want to continue the conversation with. And so for me, it's less about veterans or any one category of hire, so much as finding people that have the right skills, the passion, and I can objectively see are going to be A players. Now, if you're a veteran, great. And the one veteran we have hired has been, you know, proving in spades that I should hire more, speaking very well for that community. But it's the first time in my career that I've hired a veteran. And it was specifically because of this hiring process that led me to doing so. So happy to hire more as long as, you know, the jobs that we've got open and the person on the other side fit those criteria, then yeah, it's not a bad fit.
I'm really glad you put it like that, Kent, because I've learned that some organizations they'll hire veterans just to say that they're doing it, and they'll have a big initiative that they'll build, and they'll go out there and they're not doing it for exactly the right reasons. And then they have those same troubles with retention that you're referring to. But the thing is, the ones that do focus on their hiring practices, just like you have been doing, that plug in tools and measurements and assessments, and they really effectively screen for the top talent, those they tend to find by default that an increased number of those individuals that are those A players, they just also happen to be military veterans. So there's a really cool natural course of events, and that river flows in that direction all by itself when you plug in those hiring practices. So I'm really glad you illustrated that. Hey, would you mind sharing what the assessment is that you guys are using? I'm just curious.
Oh man, you're asking a trade secret. That's what,
okay,
I don't give up.
That's cool. We'll talk later. That I geek out on that stuff, man. That's kind of
my I didn't put too much stock into it until I had a mentor that turned me on it, and I have come the man that is behind it, I've gotten to know, and he's in his 70s and he's dedicated his career to this. And my God, the man is a wizard. Like down to the point where he reads somebody's personality assessment afterwards and say like, oh, this guy might need to brush his teeth. No, I'm teasing. It's not quite that extreme, but it is pretty interesting what he can pick out of these assessments and advice he can give. It's made all the difference. And I think that you're right. The more that I hire, I wouldn't be surprised if I see it. I've not seen that exactly. But the other thing I would mention is, you know, for me, I think that there's proof of work goes in all facets of life. If the other candidate doesn't feel like they've worked to earn the role, they're not going to show up in the same capacity as somebody that just was granted the role. And so I think it's a mistake for both parties if the hiring process isn't something that causes both sides to work a bit to get to the conclusion that, no, you're the right person for this role.
Right on.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's great stuff. And I can tell you a lot of... a lot of the veterans that I'm connected with, when they, none of them want to have any handouts. And that's the thing about some of the companies that just do it for show is we know people can tell when they're just, you know, when they're a diversity hire or something like that, just to use a generic term. I don't, can I say that on here? But, you know, we know. Well, no, not that I've ever been one of those, but I'm just going to change direction. But people know when it's a handout, and I've never met a veteran that wanted a handout. You know, it's just, you know, we want a fair shot. Okay. And we want to work for it and we want to earn it. And that's just all there is to it. So that's good. And I know that the individual that you hired, man, he definitely has got a strong, he's got a lot of proof of work going on out there, but, that is awesome, man. Thanks for sharing that. I have another question as well. Well, first of all, I guess I ought to lead straight into this, but, what are some recommendations that you may have, for individuals that are looking for jobs? Maybe they want to, you know, get plugged into the SAS mining team. What recommendations would you have for someone who wants to position themselves for success in being a strong candidate for your organization?
Yeah. So first of all, I saw that a customer just showed up on the stream and said something. I didn't catch who the customer's name was, but SAS mining customer, that was rad. Yeah, Brandon, thank you, man, for showing up here. But I think the answer to your question, and I've seen this across several Bitcoin companies at this point, there is so much passion and desire to work for a Bitcoin company, and it is incredibly difficult to build a Bitcoin company because it's a protocol, right? That you're building and trying to figure out some way to deliver value to others with. And as a result, it's not like it, you know, there's not like there's the ease of funding some token scheme, right? And so finding valuable business models that investors will invest in that are going to exceed the investment opportunity in Bitcoin is non-trivial. And so there's a lot of demand for the roles from Bitcoiners, especially once you start to get established. And I would say from what I've seen most successful people do is figure out some way to build value for the company that you want to work with such that the relationship is there. And when the opportunity to hire and fill a role shows up, like you can apply and know, look, there's a bit of a relationship that'll take me further. Or maybe in a pinch, they just throw you in, pull you in off the bench. But I think that if you're trying to come in and brag about your accomplishments versus showing up with your hat in hand and saying, hey, how can I help? I think you're going about it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's awesome, man. Thank you for that. Do you guys have because I have another question that I'll revisit something
keep,
that you said
going earlier. For now. I have other questions too, but I'm in no rush, man. Please, cool. Please continue.
I do have a question, and this is a little bit more about the business model. And of course, I know, you know, trade secrets. I will respect that. Of course, you mentioned earlier that you know the whole idea is to mine it and to not buy it. So can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I'm pretty sure that a good amount of people right now, you know, they're buying it off of exchanges, and that's how they're obtaining their Quan. Help me understand a little bit more behind that. So what's the difference? I mean, why would someone want to mine it when they can just go and buy it?
Well, simple answer is it's cheaper, right? So we've calculated our cost to mine a Bitcoin, and this is pre-halving, right? The numbers do change as network conditions change, but the last time we calculated a few weeks ago is about $24,000 to mine a Bitcoin with SAS mining right now, right? Now, post-halving, likely to change. However, it will change post-halving, but that's the fundamental driver of demand for a business. So how do you actually mine and acquire Bitcoin for cheaper? Well, you're doing it because you're purchasing a mining rig and you're paying for electricity on a monthly basis. And so what you're doing is you're dollar cost averaging into a Bitcoin position where the sats are sent directly to your wallet in a non-custodial way. You know, we don't have identity verification schemes because all we do, we're a service provider. We sell the hardware, we take care of the mining rig on your behalf, and you earn the sats from that. And our business model actually is very aligned with our clients. And what I mean by that is we don't put markups or margin on the sale of the mining rigs. And we don't also put it on the hosting rates either. Instead, we pass those through at cost. And instead, we have our profit completely transparent with our clients and aligned with them because we have the block reward when it's paid out from the mining pool. We have that split. So we receive just 15%. So that's 100% our transparent, clear profit margin on every rig is the payout on the back end. But it's also aligns our interest. It also aligns our interest with our clients because now we care about how quickly are the rigs being deployed, how much uptime can we get with the rigs, how quickly can we turn them with repairs. We want the same thing. So if customers are suffering because they're not receiving revenue in the form of block rewards, we're not either.
That makes sense. And did you say that the arrangement is non-KYC?
Well, I don't like to use that term. I don't really want to wave a red flag in front of a bull here. But yeah, we have non-identifying sats that we send out.
Got you. Okay. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick comment on that, Kent. If you're new to Bitcoin and you're discovering the space, there's a lot of what we talk about in Bitcoin where Bitcoin reassesses and reconstitutes incentive structure. And I think Kent, laid this out really well here for his particular business model where, I see some different things over at Swan that align this, this positive incentive structure. There's something that happens within Bitcoin where there's not only, competition, but there's this camaraderie. And when you start to mix those two things together, you're doing a couple of things. A lot of times what you're doing is not only good for the network, but it's also good for the individual. And so there's always been, do we put the individual first or do we put the society first? And what Bitcoin is doing is making the best for both worlds at the same time. And to see that evolve into business practices in your company and in Swan and, within this, this ecosystem and in these industries is really something to behold. And so if you're out there and you're looking at these kind of things and maybe you're not having as much success launching whatever Bitcoin business it is that you are, maybe you need to look at your incentive structure. Maybe it needs to be competitive and cooperative at the same time. And that's going to be one of those things that maybe propels you into a higher echelon in this Bitcoin industry.
Great advice.
I was going to ask you, I'm just curious, in terms of mining, how much are you guys doing in terms of exahash right now at SAS?
Oh, gosh, we just climbed into the exahash range. I think, we launched our first facility, 1 megawatt facility in Wisconsin, and I had no idea the reputational hangover from adjacent business models to ours. The Bitcoin mining as a service business model is way too close to cloud hosting and some other actors that have not necessarily treated customers the best. And so we were hit out the gate with just tons of, you guys are a scam, run away, you know, like just being egged out the gate for days. And, you know, some customers gave us some trust, tried us out. And okay, we got the first facility filled. We proved we were legitimate going to Paraguay, more questions, more scam, but now we're going in Paraguay. And so I think we are just, because we've survived the bear market, I think we're now moving out of the phase of being accused of being scammers. And now they're starting to be seen as good actors in the space. But I think that the reputational hangover was non-trivial to get past, to get operational. But we've got 5 megawatts. We're about 2/3 full with that 5 megawatts in Paraguay. And so once deployed, we will be at about half an exahash, right? So somewhere around that area.
It's really impressive, especially when you're doing this off of, you know, natural resources. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it, and more proud of the friggin' team that's doing it, right? Like I'm the guy on the camera talking to you guys, right? But there's a whole group of people that are working day and night that are actually getting it done. And I mean, it's pretty magical to see. And you know, we're really pioneering a new trajectory, because to date, nobody has built like a software platform to optimize and make this experience intuitive for people. So we're the first to do it. So there's no, you know, there's no roadmap for what we're doing. It's like, we got to run into brick walls all the time, figure out, oh, we need to do it like this, and we got to change our software like this. So, you know, the development resources are actually quite intense. And you know, you'd be surprised at how complicated actually something that sounds simple like billing is, right? Measuring electricity is non-trivial. It is a flowing force. And it's not just a number that shows up in your spreadsheet, but you got to figure out a way to measure that right. That live energy.
Yeah, and every rig is going to have its own draw, right? Like, so being fair about that and making sure you're not necessarily paying the bills of the guy's rigs that are sitting next to you and all that kind of thing is probably pretty.
Exactly. Pretty, yeah, it's more complicated than you think. There's a lot of operational challenges with that. And so, you know, that was because we got hit with curtailment in Paraguay that we didn't anticipate would be as extreme. It caused us to have to redo our entire billing structure, which had been based on kind of level set billing with an annual adjustment. And instead, we had to go through and say, okay, look, curtailment, this is going to vary. Summer months is going to hit people hard, and in winter months is going to be barely any. So we can't be charging people level set throughout the year. It's just not going to work. So that's, and we've not completed that effort yet. We're still undergoing it, but that was a big retooling effort, big learning. But you know, the guys are stellar that are doing this stuff, and I'm damn proud of what they're accomplishing, taking on these challenges.
So you mentioned something a little while ago about like there's been a couple other entities in sort of similar sort of business models, maybe somewhat similar, whatever the case may be, similar enough that people draw analogies or whatever. And I'm sure people are curious, do you have certain protocols or certain things that you guys do that would ensure that some of these stories that people have heard about some of these other entities, not you, but how they would not happen with you?
Yeah, I think we will get better at de-risking our business from those things as we scale. But I've really relied on a decade in the construction industry. Like rooftop solar is at its core, it's a construction project that people are putting up on their roof. And I dealt with countless contractors, and I learned some tricks of the trade there that I've been able to leverage. Like it took me a while to realize this, but I actually think rooftop solar is the only analogous industry on the planet to Bitcoin mining. It's disruptive, it's decentralized, it's distributed, it's energy, or your profits are constrained by an energy network, and your primary product comes from China, right? Like those are all exactly the same across both industries. And so wildly, I was able to pull through some of those like operational lessons that I learned coming from another industry and apply them. And I do think that, you know, we're moving through a time phase with Bitcoin mining that I experienced with rooftop solar. So circa 2005 to 2010, it was very technician driven, how solar was sold. And the regular Joe just couldn't meet that. And so people didn't embrace it in a very big way. And then as soon as like the language set started to change and started to meet the market where it was, the capital unlocked and you saw rooftop solar explode, at least in the markets where it made sense. And I think the Bitcoin mining industry is going through something similar, where it's primarily been driven by the technologists. And I think that now you're starting to see people come in and say, hey, how do we explain this in a way that's simple enough for the average person to participate? And we're really focused on that because I see that as a key to unlocking more capital to flow into this industry and secure the network in a more more powerful way.
Sure. So I in the work that I do, I talk to oftentimes people who are just coming into Bitcoin. They're taking their first positions in Bitcoin. The client profiles are typically, you know, higher net worth, some of them very, very high net worth. And on occasion, we talk to people who are just right out of the gate. They're interested in learning more about mining and getting involved in mining, right? So could you explain, like, what are the opportunities or the ways that people can get involved with SaaS mining? Like, what would somebody do? Like, if a guy was brand new coming in saying, okay, I have some capital, I'm not sure whether I want to allocate this directly to Bitcoin right away, or maybe I should be buying some mining rigs, or what's the go here? And how does that work with you guys?
So I would point them, I mean, we are doing some capital raising. I'm going to be pitching in Madeira. So that, quick plug for that at Bitcoin Atlantis. But the primary way that an investor like that would come in, and we'd just talk to him and say, hey, look, like, how much do you want to allocate? And what is your goal here? Is it highest ROI in terms of fiat terms? Or are you looking for the most Bitcoin that you can possibly get? And that, so that there's two different mining rig models that drop out of that question. And then focus on, okay, this is what it's going to take. This is what we estimate the return is going to be. And we don't ever forward project because we don't want to get ourselves into the SEC crosshairs. But we say, look, this is what your return would look like if the hash price stays where it is right now. And I think, honestly, hash price is probably the most the least understood but most valuable metric that should be understood out there, which is how much can I make in dollars per terahash per day? And when people start to understand that number and get their head wrapped around it, the whole thing demystifies, especially when you put up a chart that shows, look, this is what the volatility of that hash price does. This is what happens during the different phases of the cycle. Like, people can really start to grok the opportunity a lot better and see, look, like, the way you need to think about it, I'm sure you do the same, Alex, is you're not thinking about this as an investment today and what's its return next month. Like, that's fiat thinking. That's the short-term disease, right, that fiat's led us to. If you can think at least in four-year terms, you're going to win. Right. And so we look at it from this is a fiat cycling tool into a Bitcoin position over time. So it's a dollar cost averaging tool. But you do need to produce or make that first purchase of the mining rigs to get started.
Can you give that definition of hash price one more time? It's dollars per what per day?
Dollars per terahash per day. And so Typical mining rig out there, let's say, latest generation, most powerful mining rig is 200 terahash, right? I just was looking at this with a client earlier today. It's 8.3 cents is the value of a terahash per day right now. So you just simply multiply that by 200. You're, what's that? 1660. So $16.60 is what an S21 200 terahash will generate per day right now. Now, the wild part has been, what does it do during the peak of the bull mania? What does it do after halving? And that chart is fascinating to look at. But the end story of that is most people have to weather some suffering right after the halving to set themselves up for the golden opportunity, which is when Bitcoin's price runs. Here's the biggest secret that I've learned in Bitcoin mining is that you have to be plugged in before the price starts to rip. Because once the price starts to rip, the opening for getting through to be able to get plugged in becomes vanishingly small.
Explain that. Why does that happen?
Because it actually takes infrastructure and electricity and rack space to all come together for you to have an opportunity to mine Bitcoin. if you wait for the price to start to rip and say, okay, I want to do this now, well, guess what? You and 10,000 other people on the planet are trying to do the exact same thing.
So that's what it is. It's a herd of elephants trying to fit through this tiny little space, right? The price is ripping. Everybody gets the brilliant idea all at the same time. Everybody's like, I'm going to be a Bitcoin miner.
I'm going to mine this and make money.
Right.
That's your multiplier. Yeah.
And you want to have, obviously, as you say, you want to have the data centers set up. You want to have the rack space set up. You want to have the power allocation, all that done ahead of time, because otherwise you're just, that makes a great deal of sense.
When we're forecasting for this, something like this, and you guys are looking out to the halving, obviously 16 to 18 months after the halving, things get pretty nuts. How soon before a run does somebody need to be set up? I mean, realistically, with a little bit of buffer built in, if somebody wants to go and get into mining before this big run's coming, what would you tell them? Like, how long before?
I would say, I don't know. I genuinely don't. The reason why is because, like, I can tell you, like, what's happened the last few cycles. But, I mean, I think you guys are reading the tea leaves. Like, this cycle is setting up to be something different in a pretty massive way. So I don't know what that opportunity looks like. And also, and here, I will give you objective reason why I don't know, is because we've never seen a hash rate chart do what it's done since 2021, right?
Yeah, it's like, been actually, yeah.
There used to be a cycle with hash rate. That's right. Gone. So what does that mean for prediction? I don't know. What I just tell people is get plugged in as soon as possible, because if the hash price has not started ripping yet, you know, we still got opportunity. Like, just go. Like, I've actually become very left curved about Bitcoin mining, which is basically buy the most efficient mining rig, get it plugged in at the cheapest price, and just keep doing that over and over again. And you will win, as long as you have a 4-year time frame and you've got the income to support that particular habit.
It's really good.
So there's a couple ways for folks to get involved with SaaS mining right now. Is that correct? I mean, they can get the rigs through you. Is there a rig transfer option that they have as well? How does that work out?
Yeah. So we're not trying to profit on the mining rigs, you know, we will quote bigger orders and be more customized about it. It's a different sort of sales process over about 20 mining rigs. And so we do that on a more custom basis. You know, it's very e-commerce driven for under 20. But then if you are somebody that's been big into the hardware market, you like our opportunity, and you just say, look, I've got a relationship with a supplier, I know I can get the best pricing. Okay, great. No problem. Go get your mining rigs and ship them to us. Now you do have to ship enough volume to make that worth our while. Mm-hmm. But assuming that you want to do that instead and go procure your own mining rigs, then yeah, we'll just take on the shipping and logistics and make sure we get them deployed to the site. We have had a couple of clients that have chosen to do it that way. Some of them, I think, have done so thinking that they could lower the fees with customs, but sadly they found out otherwise.
Yeah, I was surfing around on your website earlier, and it looks like the process is just, it looks like it's really very, very straightforward and simple to do. I think that's awesome. What kind of feedback are you getting from people that are signing up with you on that? I imagine it's all positive. Is there, and I'm also then wondering what type of visibility do people have on their rigs after they sign up with you? Is there a way that they can access what's going on with it? How does that look?
Yeah, we've got a custom dashboard, and there's a lot more that we want to do with it. I would say that the process for purchasing a mining rig is designed to be like Web 2 intuitive. You know, when you go to a good website, e-commerce sort of website, like that's been the approach that we've taken. And I would say we haven't got too much feedback on it, which tells me that we're winning there, because no news is good news when people aren't complaining. But it sort of fits in with what people are used to from like a web-based experience. On the back end, once you're deployed, or even before you're deployed, you set up an account with us and you've got your own custom dashboard. And we've really put a lot of thought into what to display. And we display things like, hey, what's your hash rate been over the last 24 hours? How much Bitcoin have you received so far? What's waiting at the pool to be paid out? Because, you know, you don't want to just stream the sats because of transaction fees. The the pools pay out when I think it's like 400,000 sats that have been mined. And then, you know, we show when the payouts are, we show all of the payouts on the blockchain. So we have all the transaction IDs. So you can just click and go track all your payouts directly on the blockchain. And I think the fan favorite sort of dashboard element that we've got is this little chart that shows, hey, this is how much I've paid so far. And this is where my break even point is. And so you can just see like, hey, because, you know, you're paying more each month because of hosting costs. And we've got it in two flavors, right? Which is like, this is the value of the Bitcoin at the time it was mined. And this is the value if you just held it. And I can show in a very simple way to all my clients, like I started mining with my mining rig in Wisconsin 1 year ago at 7.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And, oh, I didn't know that that works. At 7.5 cents per kilowatt hour. I've broken even. I just posted that on Twitter like last week. I broke even. So in the depths of a bear market, 7.5 cents, what people told me I couldn't do, I've now done.
What's a guy like, if a guy wanted to come in and get one rig, like what for one of those 200 terahash rigs, what's somebody going to pay to do that right now?
Yeah. Click that shop rigs button right there. We'll see together. I think we just
shop rigs. Green.
So there's our two options. The most affordable is this highest ROI.
Wow. It's cheaper than I thought it was going to be.
In fiat terms, and then the 195 is what we offer. It's actually a better value than the 200, so we chose that instead, and it's just as efficient. And so yeah, you just choose how many you want, and then you'll see the taxes and transfer fee that are added, and you can see in dollar terms or Bitcoin terms what your monthly revenue will be. And that's after our 15% block reward. And it's also conservative in that it's based on the price of Bitcoin over the last 3 months, like not just today.
Okay. So I was going to ask, like, when you were describing it before, people could like send you rigs and all this other kind of stuff. I was thinking, man, like that would possibly create some sort of like a maintenance potentially nightmare, right? If let's say you got 20 different kinds of rigs, and how the hell do you keep all these things running? And like, you know what, but it seems to me that you narrow in on specific ones, so that probably reduces some of that, I'm guessing.
It does. And I'd say, you know, we focus in on the What's Miners and Bitmain mining rigs, and one of the lessons we've learned is the two models are basically the same across. I'm sorry, I've got a little.
Oh, it's life, brother. That's good.
Yeah. Hey, that's my 5 year old. Yeah. So yeah, the Amazon is full of life. What can I say? So we have accepted primarily what's miners and Bitmain, and those models are, they're very similar model to model, we'll say. You know, like once you learn how to break down and work with a What's Miner, you can work with pretty much any model of What's Miner, and same with Bitmain.
So what's the like max capacity you could like let's say somebody came in and they wanted to like maybe do a bunch of these. Is there a maximum you can do, or
right now? Yeah, we've got about 550 spots left at the moment in our Paraguay facility. And then I've got to go find more capacity. And I've just started those conversations. It's partially why I'm out raising capital. But that's once we're out of space, we're out of space, right? I can't put more rigs on rack space. Now I am fairly certain that I will have. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Then what's a guy paying? In if he gets a rack, let's say in Paraguay, and you can choose, I suppose, right? If someone comes to you and says, I want to buy a couple of these, could they pick Paraguay? And then if so, what kind of power costs are they getting?
How does that Paraguay work? Paraguay is the only choice. And okay. It's 4.7 cents per kilowatt hour, and that includes maintenance on the hosting fee. To give you an idea, that 4.7 cents, unless you've analyzed your electric bill, which most people haven't, you probably don't know what that means, and that's totally fine. The average electricity price in the U.S. is about 17 cents per kilowatt hour, and yeah. Nobody can mine profitably on that. at least at this point, maybe at the very peak of the bull market, people could. And that's really what the problem that we solve is, it's not accessible to mine Bitcoin at home. Not, I mean, you can play the lottery ticket. You know, I'm a big fan of those small little hashing USB drive things, but, and, you know, heat your house too and drop your heating bills. But if you want to properly mine Bitcoin, it really isn't accessible at home.
Very cool. Okay. I got one last question. I've been asking a lot of questions. If you guys got anything else, I'll shut up after this. What do you guys do with pools? Can people pick their pools? Do you have specific pools you're using, or how does that all work?
Yeah, I wish we had more optionality here at the moment, but we are integrated in with Luxor. It is the one trade-off that we've not been able to overcome just yet. And the reason why is because we instruct the pool to split the block reward on payout. And so we have to have a deep technical integration with Luxor to do that. And I've just not had the dev capacity to prioritize that particular feature, but we do want to add more mining pools in the future so that people can, you know, click on their dashboard and say, hey, I want to mine at this pool or that pool. But we do have a couple of restrictions, right? Like, we want to go with mining pools that are non-identifying, let's say. And we also want to have, like, not all mining pools offer that feature to split the payout to two parties when the mm-hmm. rewards are paid out. I think that more mining pools will be adding that in the future though.
Very cool. Well, that's all I got. Anything else?
I'm gonna give you a bit of a, we got about 6 minutes left. Want to be very respectful of your time. One of the things we ask of everybody that comes on the show is share a story with us, a funny story, something that, you know, is good. Maybe it was embarrassing, something that didn't go your way, whatever it is within your industry, you know, because a lot of these guys are veterans and they've got great veteran stories and all that kind of stuff that they share with us. But yeah, I know, putting you on the spot. Here at the last, Randy, I don't know why you didn't warn him, but no, I'm just
I'll give you, I think one of my most embarrassing stories is, you know, I've dedicated my career to Bitcoin, and I still find it hilarious that you know, my wife supports what I do, but she's been an NFT-er and very much into that whole gambling-esque side of things, and so that's an embarrassing tell. And she used, the last cycle is when she got into it. She got it all into flipping NFTs and playing that whole game. And I was like, oh God. And tried my best to orange pill, like, no, Ethereum's faster. All this, you know, I was like, but it's about money, honey, you know, all this stuff. Now she's like, okay, this Bitcoin thing, I get it. Like, I'll play with ordinals now.
Oh, no.
Oh man, that's awesome.
That's pretty good, Kent. Any final questions for you guys?
Well, I just want to thank you for coming on and sharing your insights. Yeah, I'm thrilled to know that your new guy is working out, who's a veteran. And I don't think we exposed him on here. So that's a good thing. His identity is safe. Hopefully he's going to keep rocking his Bitcoin veteran's hat, whether he's sleeping or whether he's in the shower. But we don't need photographic evidence of either one of those things. I'm just going to leave it at that. But thank you for sharing your insights on your hiring practices, and for sharing your advice and your guidance on how veterans and how really anybody can position themselves for success within the industry. And it really, you know, it comes down to those core principles. You know, I mean, proof of work, it matters. Add value, show up and bring what you got, and get shit done. And that's really how people are going to make their contributions. And you're clearly doing that in your way in the Bitcoin space. And I think it's awesome. I'm going to be shopping for shopping online for one of your rigs. Just throwing it out there. And if you have I saw that there's a code on there, discount code. So if there's a special one for the CEO, just feel free to shoot it my way, and we'll just keep that between us, even though we're streaming this live all over the world right now. But no, thank you for being here. I appreciate you. And I'm looking forward to I'll be in Madeira next week, man. So I'm going to track you down and shake your hand in person. And I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, thanks for being here, man.
So just a quick, comments.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kent.
No, please.
I was just going to make a couple quick comments, kind of housekeeping stuff as we wrap up here and then hand it off to Kent. You and Shane can close it up. But this part of what we're doing here, Operation Bitcoin, that Gabe is heading up, the whole professional training, job placement, small business support for veterans thing, is one small part of a lot of the different things that Bitcoin Veterans is currently doing. If you're new to this, either channel, this show, or our organization, there's a lot of other stuff that we do. There's the Brave Mission that Shane leads, that is a leadership and PTSD thing. There's a Citadel Network that we've got going on, which is basically currently all across the United States. But if anybody else wanted to be involved, I'm sure that would be fine. It's basically homesteading, Citadel builders, resilience-minded people. We've got this ham radio group going on where we're going to build a network of ham radio relays all across the United States of America. Oh, by the way, the gentleman who's going to be, who's basically in charge of that. Congratulations, Gary. You know who you are. You're now in charge of that. He's going to be helping people get licensed for their ham radio licenses at Nashville, Bitcoin Nashville 2024. So if you want to do that, come hang out and inquire. We've got a lot of other things going on. We're going to be doing a range day in Nashville. We have a whole group of people who are not military, not veterans, but civilians who are interested in being involved in the kind of stuff that we're doing. Joining us, we've got nationwide regional chat groups that we're hosting, and we've got a ton of other resources. So if you're interested even remotely learning about Bitcoin, maybe you're curious or whatever the case may be, or you are a Bitcoiner and you're a veteran, you want to find out more and get hooked up with this crew, just reach out to us. We're there for you guys.
Awesome.
Hell yeah.
Hey, Kent, from all of us at Bitcoin Veterans, man, really appreciate you hanging out with us. And from, I think, all of us, thank you for going to the ends of the earth to make this work. We've got to have people who are pioneering the space that are willing to go where people have not been, that discovery, making things work when a lot of times you're met with a lot of resistance, whether it's climate, terrain, people, politics, you name it out there. It takes this spirit. And I think this is something that I think our audience really understands, is that this never quit, never surrender, never give in type of mentality that it's going to take to make Bitcoin the premier money on the planet and hyper Bitcoinization happen across this planet. So from all of us here at Bitcoin Veterans, man, we wish you very well down there and success. And if you guys are out there and you haven't seen it yet, you can go out to Saz Mining if you're interested and maybe get a rig. It's very well priced. I mean, extremely well priced. And I think you'd be doing yourself a favor if you came in late to listen to the earlier part of the show. There's some really great tips on how you can make this one of the better investments that you have. So Kent, from all of us, man, thanks again for hanging out, and we will see you later.
Yeah, wonderful opportunity, guys. Love what you're up to. Thank you. Keep up the good work on your end, and looking forward to meeting you in Madeira, Gabe.
Awesome. Thanks, Kent.
All right, fellas.
Well, guys, are we going to stick around? We talking, or is and anything else going on that you guys want to talk about tonight before we wrap up?
Pretty slow news day. You know, I don't think that we've lost any major like cell phone carriers or anything like that. And, yeah,
that's a great place to start. I mean, yeah. I woke up this morning. I guess it was probably about 5:30 somewhere, and AT&T is reporting outages all across the country.
Pretty wild. I do want to say real quick though, man, I'm really glad that we had Kent on.
Yeah.
I mean, his background story, and I mean everything, and I mean the dude is living down there in the Amazon. I think it's awesome. He's doing some good stuff, and the guy that he hired on his team recently is, I think it's some good stuff, man. I'm glad we brought him on. But
yeah, me too.
Yeah, a little proof of work there for him too. I mean, that's a really cool thing to be able to bring a guy on that's already doing, where Bitcoin or Operation Bitcoin is headed. So that's fantastic.
It's exciting stuff. But yeah, AT&T, I guess we can talk about them however we want. But yeah, it's You know, and then you see all the conspiracies popping up and all the weird things. And I'm not saying that it isn't true. Yeah, you know, I guess we're just gonna have to wait and not find out. But interesting stuff. Solar flares.
So when you say all the conspiracies popping up, what are you specifically referring to? Because I think this is kind of interesting. Because it was reported that there was some solar flares.
Yeah, I don't know about. I didn't see any solar flares, but you know,
I didn't know they discriminated between Verizon and T-Mobile and AT&T.
Well, apparently they
do. It's a special kind of solar flare. You know, it's the kind of solar flare that only hates AT&T. Apparently,
see, and this is what happens. You know, you leave some dumb knuckle dragger that eats crayons. Just simple questions like, well, why just AT&T? You know, why are their antennas different? Why, you know, what's wrong with their network? You know, maybe consider moving off AT&T if they're going to be more subject to solar flares than the rest of them. I don't know.
Well, you know, the sun has been around for a long time and it knows the difference. So we're just going to leave it at that.
Yeah.
But it is a little weird that a lot of people, I guess millions, did not have access to call 911 if, you know, there was such a situation that occurred for them to do that. Kind of weird. Sometimes these things, some people look at them as, you know, maybe test runs for other things that may be coming down the pike. But, you know, I'm not one that is licensed or qualified to speak at great length to that stuff. But it is interesting.
What are they testing for is what I'm wondering. Like what I get, you have a certain sample set. And like, what are you checking for? Are you checking for certain kind of behaviors? Are you like,
where's Gary when you need him?
I mean, Gary, where are you at?
Are you at Gary?
Gary in the chat.
Yeah, Gary. Are we still streaming?
Yeah, we're still on.
Shit. What's up, boys?
We're off. That's why I said, should we just keep on going for a little bit? Usually I know we have an hour and a half. Maybe we'll cut it a little bit short, but I did want to just open the floor for anything that's going on in the news. I thought that, you know, outside of, you know, the conspiracy around, you know, AT&T this morning, which I will tell you, what was funny is my wife was like, I came in from stretching and she goes, you know, AT&T's got an outage this morning. And I was like, I'm mine's good. And she says, mine's down. And I was like, no, this is ridiculous. We live in the same house and the same plan, and that's we're weird. 5 feet apart. So I called her, and sure enough, straight to voicemail. Wouldn't go through to hers. And I was like, that's a really odd thing.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah. Huh. So there was another little piece of news that I thought was absolutely glorious today. The ECB, or the ECB, the European Central Bank, put out a tweet that said, Bitcoin has failed to become a global decentralized digital currency, instead falling victim to fraud and manipulation. The recent approval of an ETF doesn't change the fact that Bitcoin is costly, slow, inconvenient, and it argues the ECB blog. So the best part about this was the community notes that popped up almost instantaneously from this. And there is a boatload of them. I mean, it's comical how bad these guys got community noted today. And then in maybe the worst ratio in history.
Mm. Yeah. They forgot That's to good. Turn off replies.
Yeah. Because when I saw their post, I almost just gave up on Bitcoin and went back to whatever else I was doing before. So
yeah.
That's a relief. Whew. Yeah, there was a lot of good dialogue out there in a Twitter stand today about that. Some entertaining comments. Yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, this is probably old news for everybody by now, but I mean, what a move of desperation. You know, it's just I think it's a very strong indicator that you know, they're in the corner and they're throwing wild punches. And that's what you do. And I mean, really, what they're doing is they're. I mean, thanks for joining the Bitcoin marketing team. That's very nice of them to help to further the mission like that. And that's really what I believe the ultimate impact is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, when these same people for the last, you know, 3-4 years, you know, they went on the you know, the tear with COVID and everything else as being, you know, absolutely, you know, disgraced, for lack of a better term, you know, their credibility is gone. Their credibility is gone. The people that pushed it from the propaganda standpoint, from the legacy media, that's all gone. So whenever you've got, you know, those people that are coming out and trying to disparage anything or talk about anything sensibly, you know, it's this double-edged sword for them now. As soon as they talk about it, now they're bringing attention to the other side of it. And a lot of times, because their numbers are in the shitter, along with all the farmers that are protesting, along, you know, all the ESG and everything else. I mean, for God's sakes, maybe you guys have seen it too. I think Mercedes hasn't, you know, cut their ESG footprint now, and they're going back towards gasoline instead of going towards, you know, battery operated cars. Like, this pendulum seems to be gaining a ton of momentum right now, not only here in the States and in Europe, but in the ESG, the DEI, all of these areas that we talk about quite often, that pendulum seems to be swinging very fast right now.
Yeah. And when you say their credibility is gone, or it's reminding me of this, you know, what's his name up in Canada?
Trudeau.
Trudeau and Freeland, Christian, whatever her name is, Freeland, whatever. Yeah. They're getting sued personally because what they did apparently up in Canada was unconstitutional with the truckers and whatnot.
That's right.
And I saw a thing where he's basically, Trudeau, he's basically complaining over the fact that not everyone is no longer united around a certain set of ideals. And you know what's different now from then? What's different is the level of censorship. So not only is MSM, their numbers and their ratings and the people that are listening to them, it's absolutely in the tank, right? It's just all red across the board. These guys are hemorrhaging viewers. Nobody's watching their stuff anymore. But on top of that, now you've got Elon and X, which used to be Twitter, that has completely stepped out of line with their ability to basically manufacture the news and manufacture the narrative. And it's really, I think, screwed them up, man, because Trudeau was just, besides himself over the fact that they no longer were able to control basically what everybody knew or what everybody agreed upon.
I think I got the clip here. It is worth seeing this baby. I mean, that's what this guy is. I mean, to sit there and cry and whine about him not having...
You should blow that up. Full screen. Yeah,
let's see if I can. I can get it to there.
Bottom right, there's a little full screen button right there. See those two little arrows?
Go up. Yeah, if I do that, then it's going to cut everything out. And you
my bad.
Yeah, you guys.
You're the producer. I'll let you do the job.
I'll entertain it just for entertainment's sake. But it won't do it.
I'm backseat flying the airplane over here.
Yeah, I don't actually think this is the one. Maybe yes, it is.
News. There is
out
there a deliberate undermining of mainstream media. There are conspiracy theorists. There are the media drivers who are trying to do everything they can to keep people in their little filter bubbles, to prevent people from actually agreeing on a common set of facts the way CBC and CTV, when they were our only sources of news, used to and Global used to project across the country at least a common understanding of things.
I mean, what?
Gosh, my propaganda machine is broken.
Wow.
And I'm going to tantrum about it.
Common set of facts. Wow, that is something.
Right?
Yeah.
When we had control of media, when it was ours and we owned it and we paid these people that go out there and just read whatever the hell we want them to read, you know, it was okay because we had groupthink. Boy, what a terror. How do you call yourself a man?
Lizard.
I don't think he's that bright, man. I think
lizards don't have to be smart. Their brains are typically pretty small. I mean, you've seen them.
Little lizard brains.
I think that the term, you know, what did you say?
Oh, Gabe, we just lost your sound, man.
Oh shit.
AT&T. He's back.
Is that AT&T? Internet. Am I back? I can tell you why I said the C word. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we got you now.
So anyway, I find it interesting when he talks about his communist set of facts and the fact that, you know, they're trying to guard us from all of this, you know, misinformation now. Okay, now that people have access to, you know, what may not be their set of facts, it's a terrifying thing, man, because there is absolute and total power in information, and the person that controls the flow of it controls the minds and the wills and the actions of other people. And to lose that, man, that's a terrifying thing, especially when your ass is being sued individually as a human being by a group of people that are very pissed off that their freedom was taken from them. And he is the person that is directly responsible for it. That's not a good place to be. That's pretty scary. And he's another one of those individuals that has his back in a corner and is starting to throw wild punches, except he's crying like a little, well, he's crying about it, while he's throwing punches. So he's even worse, man. He's a soggy faced mess. He's got a puddle of something in his drawers and he's trying to sling it on other people. But the problem is he's going to go the way that, that the rest of those individuals go when, as you put it, Shane, that pendulum starts swinging the other way. He's not going to be on the right side of things. And that's well, I don't feel bad about it because, well, he earned it. So let's just watch that happen and be entertained.
Balaji had a really interesting tweet about this. About the thing about centralized information and not centralized information. He goes, brainwashing is centralized and conspiracy theories are decentralized. He goes, you call them brainwashed because they believe the official story. And they call you conspiracy theorists because you don't believe the official story. That's fascinating. I think he's on point there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right? Not to mention, here's the thing is, you know, these conspiracy theorists again, right? Like, conspiracy just takes two people. And we, you know, I've said the old George Carlin quote enough times for everybody to know is you don't need conspiracy when interests overlap. That's these guys. And, you know, I don't know, man. I look at North America right now. I mean, out of all the amazing people that we've met in the Bitcoin space alone, and you see who they've put in front of these countries, whether it's Joe Biden or Trudeau, and, you know, one is a grandfather who's dying, and this guy is a sniveling, snotty bitch. And you're looking at him and you're like, this is what fiat gets you. This is the fiat incentive system. You get fiat governments that can be bought, that legalize the plunder that the central banks do, that then turn around and wash the money so it's not a direct one-to-one thing. And then it gets put back into their coffers by the people that wash the money for them. And you're just sitting there like, this is just plain as day. And the gigs, it's all up. The fiat is dying right now.
But you're starting to see people ask questions about taxes. Like, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now on this show live.
The tax revolt.
Damn it, Shane. But you're starting to see people ask questions about stuff, which is fascinating. Because, but it's only rational, right? It's only a rational thing to do. Because, like, if you are witnessing a system where it seems to me, and there are some people who are going to disagree with that, and this, I don't care. GFY. Like, it seems to me that you have like full scale looting in progress. Like, it's gone from, we're going to do this stuff sort of kind of, you know, discreetly under the table. We're going to hide it in all these omnibus bills and do all this other kind of stuff. And that went on for decades. But at this point, it's almost like a race to see who can out corrupt who at this point. They're just like right out in the open. We don't give a crap. You know, there's tens of millions of illegals flooding into the United States of America. And they're like, give me $190 billion for this other thing over here. It's like, come on, guys, really? And at this point, you know, I woke up this morning and I was having a conversation with Suzanne about this before we got rolling for the day. I'm like, you know, it occurred to me last night that they're using your tax dollars to literally, most likely through the UN and the Red Cross and these other international NGOs or NGO, whatever the hell they're called, to literally fund the invasion of the United States of America using your money.
Yeah.
I mean, can it get any more screwed up than that?
Well, it's I think we're just starting to I don't think we've crested this hill yet. I think we're still, you know, I think we're still on this uphill. And I think when we're going to start really seeing it is when these people who are scorned, right, who are being pushed out of these very powerful positions, you're going to see it. You're going to see different levels that, you know, like those people at the very top, they're not going to be pushed out. They'll be pushed out last. So the people who are, you know, just kind of suckling down here at the lower levels of this fiat power structure, as they get pushed out and they're scorned, to watch those people, you know, like the old saying is, you know, there's no wrath like a woman scorned, right? Like when we start to see these people who feel betrayed and know the secrets, and there are too many of them to shut up or pay off or, you know, do what they do with people who are in the know about these things, that's when it's going to get really, really wild. And it's coming. I mean, and yeah. That's the thing is, you're going to see people coming out against, you know, the people in the House of Representatives, the bureaucracies are starting to already kind of happen. You're starting to see, you're going to have people come out against, you know, the senator and hell, look at Hunter Biden. Like, there are things that are being leaked about this guy, and the FBI is like, oh, what's going on? What criminality? But when this stuff starts to turn, I think it's going to turn very, very fast.
I agree. And I think that's another one of the reasons why veterans are jumping all over this. I mean, the group, and I'm not trying to like self-promote us because it's not even necessary. Bitcoin veterans has become a source of gravity. And I mean, veterans are just, they're showing up every single day.
Every day.
Because it just makes freaking sense. And the thing is, it's so important right now for us to bring these individuals into this, because the system that currently exists, this fiat system that has thrown away veterans for decades, if not longer, and that has intentionally demilitarized us and defanged us and taken our weapons, not just physical, but mental, and our proclivities and our ability to function as productive members of this society after we get out of the military, it's losing its power. And what Bitcoin does is it rearms us. It gives us those tools and those resources. It directs us in a focused, purpose-filled mission in a way that didn't exist before. And not only does it do that, but it arms us with a tool that is more powerful than anything else that they can use against us. It is by far, of course, obviously, astronomically more powerful than the fiat system, which is crumbling and is preparing to have itself driven into obsolescence now as we speak. But this group of individuals, there's something that I want to point out. Veterans aren't just, a bunch of guys that are hanging out, just kind of making it in the world, especially those that are coming onto the Bitcoin mission. We're plugged into every industry around the world. We're plugged into every social circle. We are plugged into every different type of initiative, governmental, business, private, nonprofit. We have Bitcoin veterans that are working within organizations that are in very key roles. And I'm just going to leave it at that. We're involved in the financial systems. We're involved in governmental systems. We are here and we are everywhere. And we're not going to leave. This is our mission, and we will succeed. So, anyway, I say all that. I felt like I was in that one scene from Fight Club where he's like, "Do not."
I'm about to call you Tyler Durden.
I felt like like ending scene of Matrix or something like that. Let's go.
But it's the truth, man. We're here and we're not going anywhere. We are on the mission. We're growing every single day. And I also want to throw a quick plug for BitBlock Boom. We've got an awesome discount for that. Yep. They've get a hold of us if you're going to go down there in April. We've got more and more people that are signing up for that every day. Nashville is shaping up to be an amazing event too. We've got a huge discount code for both of those events. So get a hold of us. Let us know if you're interested. If you're on the fence, it's practically free to come on down. We've got events that we're setting up for the entire week. So it's going to be awesome. But
Gabe, are you coming to a BitBlock Boom?
That one is, I'm about 85% on that one right now. So right now, you're going?
Awesome. He's going. By the way, also shout out to Big Sean Harris, hooked us up for the having party down in El Salvador. If you're interested in doing that, that's the very first week of April. We got a really cool discount code for veterans and veteran adjacent to go to that as well. So if you're interested, talk to us.
Hell yeah. Look, this is the year of the Bitcoin veterans, guys. We're making it happen and we're showing up, and it's only going to grow more from here. One of the areas where we've been focusing a little bit more on right now is on LinkedIn. And I know that some people look at it and they call it the boomer network and all that other. But there are a lot of veterans on there that need to be unplugged from the matrix, and they're asking for it, and they're seeking a way to get out of it, and they just don't know the way, just like any of us. And so that's our area of focus. If you know somebody who's a veteran, look, don't be scared to reach out to them. Don't be scared to say, hey, look, I found this group, Bitcoin Veterans. And if they look at you weird, that's cool. Tell them about it anyway. Okay. We've got to continue to spread the word. Let this source of gravity continue to grow, and let's make this happen.
Awesome. Alex, anything else?
No, man, I'm all fired up.
Yeah. I think we're probably the first guys that were scorned. And now that you say this, the veterans, and then we're everywhere. Yeah. Hey, these guys have been there. They've seen some things. They were dejected. That was it. This is Bitcoin Veterans, ladies and gents. Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks for everything you're doing out there. If you want to get involved, contact us. If you want to be put in the chats, contact us. We've got everything from civilian to people who like guns, you name it. We are here to expand this mission for sovereignty, for liberty, for anybody who's out there that is tired of the current system, that's looking for a new mission in those areas. We are here for all of that. So thank you guys so much for everything. Until next week, we will see you then. Oh, and a great guest next week. His name is Max Borders. You're not going to want to miss that show. All right. Peace.
Later, guys.
Later.